fascinated the young boy. It was all a perplexing puzzle, and so he set out to solve it. He had no plan of attack, but nevertheless it all, a sudden presto, soon fell into place. It was like when he first learned to read as a precocious 3-year-old. It just sort of happened. And so it wasn't long before the nimble-minded 8-year-old taught himself Yiddish and even Hebrew, and now, confident of his newfound talent, went on to teach himself German. Next, he got his hands on a Spanish textbook, and he quickly mastered that, too. He just had the knack. Languages never remained foreign to him for long. By the time he was 23, Meredith was fluent in at least a dozen languages, including Sanskrit. At the University of Texas, he breezed through his undergraduate degree and then went on, without pause, to pick up his master's. His professors considered him a scholar of uncommon promise. There was a good deal of talk that it wouldn't take much more work to prepare his master's thesis for publication. But years later, what remains arguably most striking about the essay, A Semasiological History of High German, is its epigraph. Meredith chose a well-known bit of Horace, and its opening words, if one bothered to translate the Latin, seemed to sum up the young, defiant outsider quite well. I hate and spurn the profane crowd. Yet it was the quotation's final lines that, years later, after all Meredith had accomplished, would prove prescient. I, the priest of the muses, sing the songs not having been heard before. And indeed he would. But in preparation for that still unimagined calling, in 1938 Meredith went off to the University of Wisconsin to earn his doctorate in German. It was apparently a troubled period for the young scholar. Was he having doubts about his calling? Was he, at last, beginning to sow his long-dormant wild oats? Meredith kept his own counsel, and so any answers can only be speculation. But what is known is that often enough to be remembered, and often enough to draw concern, Meredith would sit in seminars with his head cradled in his hands, a man sullenly nursing a massive hangover. And what would his professors say about this unscholarly behavior? A distinguished member of the faculty one morning turned to the roomful of students, gestured toward Meredith, who sat hunched in an almost fetal position, and explained to the class with benevolent understanding, "Mr. Gardner is our genius, but a genius with a bit of spice." Meredith's intellectual journey next took him in 1940 to the University of Ohio in Akron. He taught German to the undergraduates and was universally feared as a demanding and uncompromising taskmaster. "Don't sign up for Gardner's course unless you are prepared to work harder than you've ever worked before," was the warning passed around campus. And when he was not terrorizing undergraduates, he was putting the finishing touches on his dissertation, a long, deep journey into the fundamental meanings of words in High German. But as much as Meredith enjoyed being locked away in the groves of academe, after the attack on Pearl Harbor, he knew he'd soon have to enter a more dangerous world. And, not least, he was a patriot. He wanted to do his duty. So, in a way, Meredith was already prepared when the head of the department suggested to him, with a transparent vagueness, that he knew some people in Washington. They're doing some things with codes. Someone who knows German might come in handy. Would you be interested? "Yes, I think I'd like that very much," Meredith answered. He would always tell people it was a decision he made without hesitation. In the winter of 1942, Meredith reported to Arlington Hall. 4. Meredith, to his surprise and discomfort, entered a world of women. The nation's premier code-breaking facility, the Signal Security Agency, was nearly entirely staffed by female civilians. It would be renamed in 1945, with appropriate pride, the Army Security Agency, ASA. But the intelligence mandarins before and after referred to it simply as Arlington Hall. Row after row of young women sat hunched over desks performing the painstaking task of cataloging the mountains of intercepted enemy messages, or, after some rudimentary training, worked as linguists, or simply buzzed about doing clerical chores. At the height of the war, the ASA would employ over 5,000 women. But while the handful of men like Meredith, mathematicians, foreign language specialists, anthropologists, even a few undergraduates with impressive scores on IQ tests, or simply a fondness for puzzles, who had signed on for the top-secret work, knew what they were getting into, the brigade of women, although volunteers, had been pretty much shanghaied. One typical recruiting center, for example, had been set up in the midst of the daily bustle of the fortress-like Lynchburg, Virginia post office building on Church Street. Comfortably nestled between the Blue Ridge Mountains and the James River, Lynchburg was considered a friendly, all-American sort of town by the Army brass, and so Lieutenant Posvo Carlson, a young Signal Corps officer, had been dispatched to troll for civilian female volunteers. He was armed with Nordic good looks, a bright smile, and a largely vague and often specious bill of goods. The job, he'd begin truthfully enough, was with the Army in the Washington area, and the pay would be attractive. You'd enter at the grade of SP-5 and earn $1,800 a year, plus a bonus for Saturday work. And for most of the women, many of them schoolteachers, this would be a considerable raise. But in response to the eventual question of what the job would entail, the lieutenant's lips were tightly sealed. Under orders from his superiors, he'd explain with a terseness made even weightier by the drama of wartime, he could not reveal any details. The specifics were top secret. Yet before any potential recruit's imagination could fill this void with a bleak vision of work in a subterranean bunker, Carlson jumped in with a cheerier prospect. Like a carnival barker zeroing in on his mark, he'd produce impressive brochures and picture postcards of a workplace that seemed more like a Virginia hunt country resort than a secure Army outpost. There was a shimmering outdoor swimming pool, stables filled with sleek-coated horses, a pillared yellow-brick colonial mansion as large and impressive as any they had seen in Gone with the Wind, and all these goodies were scattered about, as one brochure boasted, a 100-acre campus offering interesting variety with its open lawns, landscaped gardens, and wooded sections. Nudged on by the enticing promise of a sojourn at a well-groomed country estate and attractive pay, not to mention their own earnest desire to have a chance to help the Allied cause, hundreds of women signed on for this unexplained hush-hush Army work. Then, after a brief indoctrination in Army offices in downtown Washington, a few maddeningly non-specific hours at most, the new recruits would make their own way, quite often by taxi, to the address on Glebe Road in Virginia that had finally been revealed. And as soon as they arrived at the front gate, they'd feel betrayed. What they saw was nothing like what had been dangled in front of them. In its heyday, Arlington Hall had indeed been the manicured junior college for pampered young ladies pictured in the postcards and the brochures. But the school had already lost much of its gloss, as well as a sizable chunk of its enrollment, when the Army, brandishing the War Powers Act, purchased the property in 1942 for the court-ordered price of $650,000. Soon the pool was drained and the stables emptied. Rows of dingy barracks now lined the unkempt lawns. The interior of the mansion building had been subdivided into a maze of cramped, closet-like rooms separated by plywood walls, or simply by rows of filing cabinets. and a steel mesh fence topped with curling circles of razor-sharp barbed wire encircled the grounds. By the time Meredith, as well as the hundreds of new female recruits, arrived, the army had firmly imposed its brutal aesthetic on Arlington Hall. But while there were grumblings from many of the arrivals that they had been seduced with false promises, guilty Lieutenant Carlson made it a point to hurry off whenever accusatory stares were shot his way. Once the top-secret work was revealed, its undeniable wartime urgency put a damper on their complaints. The Army Wranglers, as the teams of cryptanalysts were known, were doing nothing less than breaking both the German and Japanese ciphers. The ability to read the enemy's encoded messages would undoubtedly save lives, shorten the war, and, if exploited with ingenuity and blessed by luck, help pave the way toward an Allied victory on both fronts. An empty swimming pool no longer seemed like a hardship when measured against the opportunity to play a supporting role in this grand effort. As for Meredith, he threw himself with his customary focus and insight into every problem that was thrown his way. The British had already made extraordinary headway on the Wehrmacht codes before he came on board, but his fluency in German helped to smooth a few lingering rough edges. Impressed, his superiors decided to turn him loose on the Japanese cables. The codebreakers here, too, had already worked wonders. First, they had untangled the new, sophisticated Japanese cipher, codenamed Purple, and then they went on to build a replica of the Purple encoding machine that employed a complex electrical rotor system, along with a 25-character alphabetic switchboard, without, miracle of ingenious miracles, ever having seen the actual Japanese device. Their inspired deductions were all intuitive suppositions. But they still needed readers who could make sense of the unlocked text. Of course, the ability to translate Japanese with effortless fluency was a prerequisite for the team, and Meredith, while he could claim expertise in Lithuanian, Sanskrit, and Old Church Slavonic, as well as the more mundane European languages of German and Spanish, did not know a single word of Japanese. So, to the amazement of his superiors, while he was also busily laboring away on the German messages, in his spare time, hunched day and night over his monastic desk in the main building, in 3 months he taught himself Japanese. As if in an instant he was fluent. He became a key member of the unit deciphering the cables traveling in and out of the Imperial War Command in Tokyo. And while Meredith's accomplishments were soon attracting curious attention from the Army Signal Corps brass who ran Arlington Hall, they were no surprise to one of the new recruits. From the moment Blanche Hatfield learned that he was working with the Wranglers, she had been keeping a curious but discreet eye on him. After all, it wasn't every day that you got to observe a legend. Blanche was not the typical Arlington Hall female recruit. She not only knew before volunteering, fully cognizant, was how it read in her file, what the Army was up to, but she had ample reason to believe she could lend a hand. It was as if, as she'd confidently informed the examiner when she'd applied, the job had been conceived with her nimble talents in mind. Not that anyone would know it to look at her. While Meredith had the brooding, rumpled mien of quirky genius, a quick glance at Blanche suggested nothing so eccentric. A precocious 23-year-old, she might have been dismissively categorized as another of those pearls and twin-setted co-eds who had populated the corridors of Arlington Hall in its previous gilded life. Hazel-eyed and with bobbed hair that, when the light hit it full force, had a bold reddish sheen, she embodied a mix of breeding and material comfort that animates women of a certain background. A well-mannered smile, yet full of a jaunty charm, completed the pretty picture. But while Blanche had indeed grown up in a big Victorian house in Evanston, Illinois, and her pedigree included well-heeled generations of prominent church and university officials. She also had a wonderful mind. Her father was chairman of the German department at Northwestern University. The keep-off-the-grass signs that surrounded his acres of lawn were posted in a pedantic variety of languages. Her brother would go on to become chairman of the German department at Harvard, and Blanche had also begun to make her way in the family business. At Mount Holyoke College, she had majored in German, getting elected to Phi Beta Kappa in the process. Then she went on to earn her M.A. at the University of Wisconsin, again in German. It was while she was working on her master's that, as she would one day tell her children, her professors had regaled the students with heady tales about one of their predecessors in the department, how he had the sort of mind that appears once in a generation, how he could grasp impossibly difficult concepts in a flash, make connections that had eluded other linguists, offer insights that were nothing less than stunning in their uniqueness and clarity. The way they talked about this grad student, he might as well have been a god. And in time he would become a sort of deity in Blanche's feverish imagination. And now here was Meredith Gardner in the ghostly pale flesh, laboring in the same top-secret code-breaking facility as she was. Blanche knew she had to meet him. She spent considerable time mulling over her approach. And even then, when she had worked out what she thought would be an appropriate introduction, flirtatious, while also making clear that she was a woman of accomplishment, she still hesitated. It was not so much that Meredith seemed intimidating. Rather, gazing at him, bent over his desk, deep in some arcane yet no doubt vital puzzle, she wondered if he would even hear her voice. He appeared totally self-contained, completely detached from all that was going on around him. An intrusion into his very private world could be doomed from the start. For days she made excuses to put off the encounter. Finally, with a sudden burst of courage, she pounced.
"Ich dachte, Sie wären eine Legende,"
she announced. And she knew there was no need to offer a translation. "I thought you were just a legend." When Meredith finally looked up, as Blanche would always tell the tale, he did not speak for what seemed ages. She waited, all the time fearing that by barging into his isolation she had committed an unpardonable sin. "He must think me the silliest of young women," she decided. But then he smiled, and a conversation, small and trivial, followed. It was only after Blanche returned to her own desk that she realized they had spoken to each other entirely in German. Fraternization at Arlington Hall was not specifically prohibited, but it was frowned on. It was a military facility, after all. And so their courtship remained one more closely guarded secret among all the many others that they protected. But it was the nature of that covert world that there was always at least one more bit of hush-hush activity swirling around in the shadows than was guessed at. And so it was at Arlington Hall. While Blanche and Meredith did their best to make sure no one knew about their blossoming relationship, in one of the few private offices in the main building, a two-member team had secretly begun to examine the blue problem. 5. Colonel Carter W. Clark was, depending on the way one looked at the world, either a realist or a deeply suspicious fellow. But since he was the deputy chief of the Military Intelligence Service, this was a caution that had its practical advantages. And so it was that even as the war in Europe continued, the colonel found himself thinking that Arlington Hall shouldn't be focused on just the German and Japanese codes. America needed to read Russia's mail, too. It was crucial, all his professional and personal instincts rose up to warn him, that the nation knew precisely what the Russians were up to. The United States already had filing cabinets bursting with Soviet message traffic gathering dust. With intermittent assiduousness, the government had been collecting copies of Russian cables, diplomatic and trade, sent to and from Moscow for years. The program had begun modestly in the more languid pre-war days, when a half-dozen or so undermanned Signal Corps monitoring stations spread from Fort Monmouth in New Jersey to Fort McKinley in the Philippines began pulling Russian cable traffic in sporadic bursts from the airwaves. Then, in 1940, in a clandestine arrangement made possible by David Sarnoff, who conveniently was both the chief executive of RCA, then the nation's major commercial telegram cable company, and a reserve Signal Corps officer, Russian cables sent from and received in RCA offices in New York, Washington, and San Francisco were routinely photographed. Working in the back rooms of RCA offices, supplied with flimsy cover stories, the Army photo technicians were, unlike the monitoring station staff, able to get perfect copies of every message. After the attack on Pearl Harbor, a wartime America quickly instituted rules for the censorship of all international mail and communications. Telegraph companies were now required to turn over copies of every foreign communication. By 1942, the file cabinets at Arlington Hall were bulging with a nearly complete inventory of all recent message traffic sent to and from Moscow. Not that it did the spymasters any good. There was never much thought or energy put into reading these cables. Early on, when the array of monitoring stations first began gathering the Russian messages, the head of the Signal Intelligence Service, Major D.M. Crawford, threw up his hands in defeat after only a half-hearted fight. "Judging by what is known of Russian cryptographic methods," he as good as moaned to his superiors, "the Russians are employing complicated, scientifically constructed systems designed to resist the organized efforts of expert cryptanalysis." Besides, in those halcyon pre-war years, knowing what the Russians were up to struck the deep thinkers in military intelligence as an abstract, largely irrelevant exercise. The national interest in the late 1930s was defined in defiantly parochial terms. Later, in the wake of the German army's blitzkrieg across Europe, Congress, with America on the sidelines and largely hoping they could keep it that way, passed the Lend-Lease Act in 1941. A staggering fortune of armaments and supplies, over $11 billion worth by the war's end, was sent, under the terms of the act, to the assailed Soviet fighters, materiel that was to be repaid in kind after the war. In this arm's-length way, the U.S. government tacitly cheered the Soviet army on, all but formally acknowledging they were fighting the nation's battles, too. And once the country entered the war, it found itself locked in common cause with the Russians. Both U.S. and Soviet soldiers shed blood in the shared battle to defeat Hitler. The two nations, if not friends, were allies. But Colonel Clark's apprehensive mind was, even as the war was still being fought, focusing on the inevitable peace conferences. A Friday night poker player, the colonel had a metaphor handy. The sessions would be high-stakes contests. It was imperative that America walk away from the table with its fair share or better of the pot. And past experience had taught him that the odds of coming out ahead certainly increased if one knew what cards the other player was holding. He confided this game-winning strategy in a carefully oblique memo to a G2 colleague in May 1942. "The end purpose is enabling an American peace delegation to confront the problems of the peace table with the fullest intimate knowledge possible, to secure the purposes and attitudes, overt and covert, of those who sit opposite them." 8 months after this hope of obtaining the fullest intimate knowledge possible had started gnawing at him, in January 1943, A small kernel of intelligence crossed his desk. It was a memo churned out by the codebreakers toiling on the Japanese problem at Arlington Hall, a minor revelation they had stumbled upon. In other circumstances, it might have gone unnoticed in the constant flow of more valuable tactical information. But at this moment it held the prospect of just the sort of game-winning advantage the KG colonel was seeking. It was a message from the general staff in Tokyo to the attachés in Berlin and Helsinki. It began, "We have commenced the study of Russian diplomatic codes and obtained the following results." The results, as outlined, were at best modest. The Japanese had not broken the Russian codes. However, with the help of the Finns, who had been exchanging cryptographic material they had recovered after the Red Army's 1939 invasion with Tokyo's codebreakers, they had made some progress. The Japanese had, as one impressed Army codebreaker acknowledged, uncovered clues. That was all the encouragement Colonel Clark needed. In the first months of 1943, it was becoming possible to envision the long endgame that would lead to the defeat of Hitler. With an expedient practicality, he now looked toward a more complicated future, and he began to ponder how signals intelligence, SIGINT, to use the professional's word, might help. On Monday, February 1, 1943, just one day before the official surrender of the besieged German Sixth Army at Stalingrad, the colonel ordered the Army Signals Intelligence Command to start work on the Russian problem. A special compartment was established at Arlington Hall. The program was top secret, and the staff was minimal, just two recent arrivals at Arlington Hall. Second Lieutenant Leonard Zubko had an engineering degree and had just completed infantry school at Fort Benning. His only qualification for this assignment, as best he could surmise, was that he spoke Russian. Both his parents were born in the Ukraine. Jean Graybeal, his co-worker, had even less apparent skills. A graduate of Longwood College in Farmwood, Virginia, she had been an unhappy high school teacher when the affable Lieutenant Carlson approached her in the Lynchburg post office. She had listened to his pitch, discussed it with her father, who agreed that it might make sense to go to Washington and shuffle papers, and as soon as a replacement teacher was found, she reported to the duty officer at Arlington Hall. 4 weeks later, she was sitting at a wooden table across from a bewildered Lieutenant Zubko in the corner of a tiny room in the main building, and lining an entire wall of this claustrophobic space were 8 shoulder-high filing cabinets, crammed with years of Russian cable traffic. They couldn't make sense of a single one. 6. Which was precisely what the Russians had intended. The messages had been encoded in an unbreakable code. It was by shrewd design, much more sophisticated, much more ingenious than either the German or Japanese systems. The Soviet cryptologists had, in effect, locked the door once, then they locked it again, and finally, just to be sure no one could get in, they threw away the key. The system worked in its plodding, laborious, and seemingly foolproof way, basically, and hypothetically, like this. A Russian spy, call him Paul Revere, came in from the cold to the New York Residentura, as the Soviet diplomatic missions were known, with an important message that needed to reach Moscow without delay. The British are coming. The cipher clerk grabbed the message from the secret agent and jumped into action. Like a diligent copy editor, he smoothed Paul Revere's unpolished prose, taking care that it conformed to all the elements of style that had been drummed into him in cipher school. He must, he knew straight off, disguise the source. The security-conscious KGB prohibited the mention of an agent's actual name in a cable. Only aliases could be transmitted. So the dutiful clerk checked a top-secret list for Revere's code name. He found it, silversmith. The rest of the brief message needed some sprucing up, too. There is no the in Russian. The article is a notion alien to the language. Also, verbs were often deleted in cables, the logic being that they were implicit and only slowed down the recipient's unbuttoning of an urgent message. Finally, per another stylistic convention, certain nouns with Western national and ideological affinities, such as British or, say, CIA or FBI, were replaced with an insider's jargon, a practice rooted more in a jaunty spy fellowship than any security concerns. Thus, British became Islanders. The edited message the clerk transcribed on his worksheet, the verbs deemed necessary, now read, "Silversmith reports Islanders coming." Of course, KGB-trained clerks wrote in Russian, using Cyrillic characters. This example, for clarity's sake, is playing out in English. With the editing of the plain text, i.e. the original message, completed, the clerk was ready to take the codebook out of the safe. The codebook was a secret dictionary that allowed the members of the club, in this case KGB officers, to communicate with fellow clubmen without outsiders being able to understand. It was employed to translate the information into the secret language, to encode it. The club's shared covert language was numerical. Words, as well as symbols and punctuation, and often entire phrases, were reduced to 4 digits. If a word was not in the KGB's dictionary, an American family name or some abstruse scientific term, for example, then there was a prearranged way to handle that, too. A specific 4-digit number was employed to announce to anyone in the club receiving the message, "Here's where we're going to begin spelling an untranslatable word." Next, the word would be spelled out in Roman letters, with 2-digit designations for each letter taken from a spell table that was an appendix to the secret dictionary. And finally, to indicate that this strange, at least to a Russian reader, word was completed, there'd be another specific 2-digit number, the end spell code. Working carefully, checking and rechecking each word in the codebook, the code clerk would soon have come up with a translation. Silversmith reports Islanders coming. 8522-7349-0763-6729. Next was another small but crucial security measure. The 4-digit dictionary words were transformed into unique 5-digit numbers by a simple bit of hocus-pocus. The initial digit of the second 4-digit group was tacked onto the end of the first group, and so on, the immediately subsequent digits moving forward until each group was now 5 numbers. The clerk's worksheet would now read like this. Silversmith reports Islanders coming, 85227-34907-63672-26729. And with this, the first lock on the door had been turned. Message had been encoded. But the turning of the second lock, the enciphering, was the precaution that ensured the door would be impossible for a thief to open. The clerk now consulted another secret code book stored in his safe, the one-time pad. It was about the size of a pocket diary, and each dense page was lined with columns of 65-digit numbers. The numbers had been randomly spewed out by a primitive computer at KGB headquarters. And, this was the sly tradecraft that rendered the final encoded and enciphered message unbreakable, only 2 copies of each one-time pad existed, one in Moscow Center, as the warren of offices belonging to the KGB's espionage and foreign counterintelligence sections were uniformly known, and the other in the cipher clerk's safe. Swiftly he went to work to put his encoded message into the protective shell of this new cipher. The procedure was quirky, but not very complex. The numbers on his worksheet would be combined with the random numbers on a specific page of his one-time pad. And, in this example, the one-time pad numbers are as imagined as the hypothetical message. However, there was one catch. The rules for addition were not as normally taught in grade school, but rather followed what mathematicians call the Fibonacci series, a non-additive system. Any number larger than 9 was not carried forward, so the clerk would go back to his worksheet and do the math. Silversmith reports Islanders coming, 85227-34907-63672-26729, plus 71148-36564-56340-32468, equals 56365-60461-19912-58187. With the creation of these new 5-digit numbers, the second lock would be firmly turned. The message had been enciphered. But there still remained one more essential step. The clerk would copy the first 5-digit group at the top left-hand corner of the page of the one-time pad he had used and stick it at the beginning of the cable. This would tell the recipient, "Turn to this page in your one-time pad to unbutton this message." If, say, the group of numbers at the top corner of the page were 67832, the message would look like this. (67832) and parenthesis 56365-60461-19912-58187. Then, and this was crucial, he'd burn the page from the pad he'd just used. And he would count on the recipient, after deciphering the message, to likewise destroy the corresponding page in his copy of the one-time pad. This would ensure that the random code numbers could never be repeated, and without repetition, the opposition wranglers would never have the advantage they'd need to untangle the code. The key would, in effect, have been thrown away. There was one further task necessary, more a routine business procedure than a security measure. Since the cable would be sent to Moscow through the circuits of a commercial telegraphic concern, the companies, such as RCA, required numbers to be converted into letters for transmission by Morse code. There was a standard conversion table. 0 equals O, 1 equals I, 2 equals U, 3 equals Z, 4 equals T, 5 equals R, 6 equals E, 7 equals W, 8 equals A, 9 equals P. Once this simple transposition was completed, the message would be sent. Within hours, the field agent's original breathless warning that the British are coming would arrive on a desk in the cipher room in Moscow. It would look like this. R-E-Z-E-R, E-E-O-T-E-I, I-P-P-I-U, R-A-I-A-W. The Moscow Center clerk would immediately roll up his sleeves and begin to reverse the encoding process, diligently converting letters into numbers, cipher into code, and code into words. When the plain text message finally made its way down the long corridors of Moscow Center to the appropriate KGB desk officer, he could read it, and more important, act on it, confident that the secret it contained had never been revealed. Certainly, the secrets contained in the rows of filing cabinets perused with daily frustration by Lieutenant Zubko and Jean Graybeal remained inviolable. They had no idea how to penetrate the code. The best they could do was follow one of the leads that the intercepted Japanese message had revealed. Looking at the cable addresses, a shorthand used by the commercial companies, they were able to divide the traffic into two distinct groups: commercial messages coming and going from the Russian Ministry of Trade, and diplomatic messages with the Foreign Ministry address. Two piles, the stack of trade messages, though decidedly higher, soon rose on the wooden table in their office. It was a start, and this activity offered a small sense that they were beginning to make some progress. Perhaps, they both wanted to believe, familiarity would in time result in deeper insights. And they received another burst of encouragement when Colonel Clark promised he would provide more manpower. Further, in a world where code names were an imprimatur of institutional importance, the brass at Arlington Hall, taking their lead from an ongoing classified Navy investigation of Russian radio networks known as Blue Caesar, now referred to the cracking of the Russian code with a cover name, the Blue Problem. But then, without either warning or explanation, 2 months after the Blue Problem had been launched, it was ended. Both Zubko and Graybeal were ordered to report to new assignments. 7. Bob Lamphere, meanwhile, was dealing with his own Russian problem. And in his world the results were no less frustrating than at Arlington Hall. For reasons he couldn't understand, just trying to work out the Bureau's logic left him livid, he'd been, as he sourly put it, shoved out to grass in the Soviet espionage squad. The work, he felt, was not merely dull, it was pointless. There were just a handful of agents, about 50 men from the 1,000 or so in the New York office, assigned to SE, and their job was to keep track of an even smaller cadre of suspected Soviet spies, operatives working under dodgy diplomatic or trade covers. It was watcher's work, and the experience, day after miserable day, had left Bob with a list of ardent reasons why it wasn't for him. He'd reel them off like the counts in an indictment. 1. Physical surveillance work was the time-honored stomping ground of the unambitious FBI agents who were eager to stay out of the office, since out of sight meant out of the supervisor's demanding minds. 2. It was passive duty, long days and nights literally just sitting around. 3. The mission was a waste of good manpower. It didn't take long for the target to get an inkling that it was more than just coincidence, that whenever he looked over his shoulder there was a stolid hulk in a suit and fedora trailing behind. What secret agent who knows he's being followed, Bob wanted to shout at his unimaginative bosses, will meet up with his contacts? And a resolute number 4. There was nothing to uncover. The Soviets, and here his logic was shared by many, including several of the G2 strategists working at Arlington Hall, were on our side. The Russian Bear and Uncle Sam were both fighting the good fight against the Nazis. Allies don't spy on each other. Bob looked back with a precocious nostalgia at his days making criminal cases, when he was on the front lines in Chinatown doing consequential work. Each wasted day sitting interminably in a car, or standing with a contrived casualness in a doorway, his eyes all the time searching for a glimpse of some inconsequential Russian, grated against his ambition. "When you get rid of one spy, another would take his place," he reasoned, his tripwire temper growing hot at the absurdity that had taken over his life. His days and nights of surveillance just went on and on. Little was breaking. While, he might have added, his career was petering away. But just as he was on the verge of surrendering, of giving up all hope of a meaningful future, a series of unexpected events began to rattle all his preconceived notions. They were seemingly unconnected, and, at least initially, in no apparent way related to his dull responsibilities. Further, Bob would later concede, as a newcomer to the SE section he was only peripherally involved in the matters. Yet, they impinged on many of my later cases in so many ways. And even at the time, one after another, they woke up a vague yet nagging sense of alarm in his mind. He grew to realize that the Russians were operating all around us. It began with a letter. It was delivered to the Bureau headquarters in August 1943, and it was the sort of communication that in most circumstances would be quickly filed away and just as quickly forgotten. It was anonymous, postmarked Washington, D.C., and addressed, with an annoying presumptuousness, to Mr. Hoover. There was one characteristic, though, that distinguished it from the flood of crank letters that arrived regularly in the FBI post office box. It was in Russian, typed in Cyrillic letters. When it was translated, it told a fascinating story. "Exceptional circumstances," the unnamed writer dove in without prelude, "impel us to inform you of the activities of the so-called director of the Soviet intelligence in this country." What followed was a compelling espionage story, a gossipy insider's description of a 10-member Russian spy network operating in America, headed by Vasily Zubilin. Working under the banal diplomatic cover of second secretary at the Soviet embassy, this short, stocky, tweedledum of a man was, the letter claimed, the crafty deputy head of the KGB Foreign Intelligence Directorate Service and the chief KGB officer in the United States. No less startling was the assertion that his wife, Elizabeth, an unsmiling harridan who by all accounts treated her husband with undisguised contempt, was also a KGB field agent who ran her own network of well-placed agents. It was pure intelligence gold, unless it was fool's gold. Some SE bosses argued that the letter was a shrewd bit of disinformation by the Russians to divert attention from the real brains behind their operation. The attempt to put the spotlight on a most improbable spy, and his even more improbable shrew of a wife, was a joke that must have left them laughing in Moscow Center when they dreamed it up. Others at the Bureau suggested that poor Zubilin had probably slept with a colleague's wife or docked an assistant's pay, and this letter was the angry man's mischievous payback. It fell to Bill Harvey, the resident Bureau expert on counterintelligence, to make a final judgment on the letter. Bob had worked with him, and once he'd gotten over Harvey's disconcerting appearance, the pear-shaped body, the eyes that always seemed to be on the verge of popping out of their sockets, and, another oddity, his croaking foghorn voice, he had come to realize that Harvey was damn smart. He had a way of looking at a situation, separating the facts from the speculations, and then doing the sort of intelligence arithmetic that made it all add up. After much consideration, Harvey decided the letter was largely the real thing. It documented personnel who had long been active in illegal, conspiratorial, and quasi-intelligence operations. The letter was short on operational details, but its implicit message was disturbingly clear. The KGB was up to something in America. The next shoe crashed down with a more resounding thud. But perhaps that was to be expected when Russian thugs battered down an apartment door to get their hands on a defector running for his life. The Corby Affair, the code name taken from the brand of rye whiskey that fueled the interrogators during the long weeks when they were hunkered down with the defector in a lonely safehouse deep in the Canadian woods, had its roots in a small moment of carelessness. Igor Guzenko, a 25-year-old cipher clerk who toiled in the imposing red-brick Soviet embassy on Charlotte Street in Ottawa, Canada, had left a piece of paper on his desk. Access to Cipher Room 12 was only attained after navigating a daunting gauntlet. A bell artfully concealed beneath the main banister must be pressed. A spy hole in a thick steel door would slide open, and then, if the bruiser standing guard approved, one door and then another, the second as solid as the door on a bank vault, would swing free. Inside the cipher room, the stringent KGB insisted on a litany of security precautions, and Guzenko had broken one of the most fundamental. Eager to get home to his pregnant wife, he had rushed off before storing a top-secret cable in the room's safe. It was still lying on his desktop the next morning when Guzenko returned. Chagrined, the young clerk hurried to lock the evidence of his indiscretion away, but it was too late. A cleaning woman, who also doubled as a KGB informer, had already alerted the KGB resident at the embassy. Within days, an icy cable from Moscow ordered Guzenko home. He didn't want to go. For the past 15 months, Guzenko, his pregnant wife, and their young daughter had been living in the nearly regal comfort of a centrally heated 2-bedroom apartment on Somerset Street, shopping in stores stocked with an unimaginable bounty of goods. The prospect of a diminished life in Moscow, of raising 2 children in such deprivation, was too grim. Desperate, Guzenko came up with a plan. Full of cunning, as well as no small measure of daring, he spent weeks conscientiously assembling a wide-ranging inventory of state secrets. He held back documents marked "burn after reading." He copied classified cables. He discreetly turned down the corners of top-secret papers in the files so that he could grab them when the time seemed right. Then, on the evening of September 5, 1945, just 3 days after the end of the war, he made his move. He hastily stuffed his trove into his pants pockets and under his shirt. He looked, he fretted, as bloated as the Michelin Man. The security thugs would certainly notice. But when he signed out, Guzev, the hulking KGB man at the door, just gave him a perfunctory nod. Guzenko walked down the front steps, waiting to hear his name shouted, ready to feel a heavy hand on his shoulder. But he made it all the way to the street, and then to the corner. A streetcar stopped, and he boarded, heading downtown. Guzenko returned to his apartment on Somerset Street. He and his wife were huddled together, anxiously trying to determine what to do next, when they heard an assertive pounding on the front door.
"Guzenko," an authoritarian voice bellowed. "Otkroyte dver."
"Open the door." The family quickly escaped out the back door, which opened onto a rear balcony shared with another couple. These neighbors, a Royal Canadian Air Force sergeant and his wife, quickly appraised the frightened young couple, heard the repeated thumping on the door across the hallway and the accompanying angry growls in an incomprehensible language, and decided the Guzenkos had better take refuge with them until things were sorted out. By the time the constables arrived, the door of the Guzenkos' apartment had been smashed open, and a crowd of Soviet diplomats, some in military uniform, others in civilian clothes, were in the midst of systematically tearing the place apart. There was a tense confrontation, but it ended with the Soviet intruders indignantly claiming diplomatic immunity, while the Guzenkos were led off under the watchful protection of a half-dozen broad-shouldered Royal Canadian Mounted Police. A day later, Guzenko was hidden away in a cabin in Camp X, a wartime training base for special operatives located deep in the snowy Canadian woods. Corby, as he was now identified in the secret transcripts, had only just begun spilling all he knew when 2 inquisitors, buddies of Bob's from the FBI's SE squad, arrived to claim America's share of the spoils. They listened with stunned concern and then hurried to send a flash cable to their superiors. Guzenko's cache of documents had revealed that Russia had, as one agent put it with shivery rage, stabbed Canada in the back. Its secret agents were aggressively running networks of spies north of the U.S. border. But Guzenko's knowledge had its limits. He couldn't shed light on how the KGB's activities in Canada fit into Moscow Center's master plan. Still, his evidence, once unimaginable to many who had labored in the wartime U.S. intelligence community, now led Bob inescapably to another even more unsettling question. Was there any reason not to assume that Russia had done the same to another of its allies, the United States? Or worse? The answer to that question grew clearer to Bob a few weeks later, when the Red Queen, as the tabloids would ultimately coronate her, came out of the shadows. Elizabeth Bentley was the daughter of solid New England stock, a graduate of Vassar with a pert smile, shy charm, an inquisitive nature, and a very impressionable mind. She fell into espionage in stages, drifting along as circumstances, rather than a hard-driving dialectical commitment, pulled her in deeper and deeper. While doing graduate work at the University of Florence, she had a fling with fascism. Mussolini's strident right-wing rantings gave her, she'd gush, goosebumps. But after she returned to the States and began studying for a master's in Italian at Columbia University, she did a complete about-face. Bentley joined the Communist Party, mostly attracted, she would later explain, by the convivial community and rigid structure it brought to her lonely graduate student life. And for several years this new infatuation served her well. Bentley was, as she frankly described herself, an average run-of-the-mill communist. Her previously empty social calendar, now jammed with a hectic schedule of meetings, demonstrations, and working dinners with her tight circle of party friends. Looking to earn some money while she continued her studies, in 1938 she found a job as a secretary at the Italian Library of Information, just a short subway ride from her apartment near Columbia. She hadn't been working there long before she realized that the only information the library dished out was fascist propaganda. A loyal party member, she approached the leaders of her cell, offering to get the goods. She'd give them the proof of what the library was really up to. They brusquely explained there were more important concerns. But Bentley, her indignation at being duped when she took the job fueling her persistence, wouldn't take no for an answer. And in time, the harassed party officials passed her plan on to Jacob Golos. Golos was the real thing, a Russian-born and Moscow Center-trained KGB operative based in New York. And he always had his eye out for new talent. He saw something in Bentley's enthusiasm, her amateur's eagerness to play spy. So he let her run with her small-time operation against the Italian library. Under his tutelage she was listening at closed doors, furtively sorting through her boss's trash. And as Bentley lurked in the shadows, as she discovered the thrill that came with her new covert life, something unexpected happened. Golos had first struck her as rather colorless and shabby, a little man in a battered brown hat, nondescript suit, and well-worn shoes. But their shared danger proved to be a powerful aphrodisiac. She no longer paid much attention to his scuffed shoes. In her revisionist history, Golos grew in stature. He was now powerfully built, with a large head, very broad shoulders, and strong, square hands. His eyes were startlingly blue, his hair bright red. And as if to seal the deal, she decided, his mouth was very much like my mother's. With her eyes wide shut, Bentley fell in love with the KGB man. Golos, who had a wife and a son back in Moscow and a mistress in Brooklyn, soon added Bentley to the queue. Only, in addition to being his lover, she also served as his courier. Golos ran a widespread network of diverse and valuable contacts, from a chemical engineer who was passing on blueprints of secret industrial processes to a Washington-based cell with high-placed assets in the Treasury Department and even the White House. And Bentley was Golos's indefatigable legman, to use the jargon of her new profession. In her knitting bag, an inspired bit of tradecraft that even the veteran KGB man admired,